The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder, how do we know that the Bible is the correct Bible? Especially in the New Testament, aren't there all kinds of other gospels that never made it in? Gospels that the early church kept out due to some hidden agenda? What about the Gospel of Thomas? What about the Gospel of Mary? You've heard of these other gospels, and you're wondering, what is the deal with them? Well, these additional gospels, commonly called the Gnostic Gospels, will be discussed later on in today's program, but we got a lot of stuff today. I feel like the carnival barker, but wait, there's more, much more. Where did Jesus go between Friday and Saturday, specifically the Friday he was crucified, what we call Good Friday and Easter Sunday? He died. He rose from the dead bodily on Sunday. Where did his disembodied spirit go? Did he go straight to heaven to be with God the Father? Actually, believe it or not, the Bible gives a pretty clear answer to this. But there's also a lot going on in the news. More revelations about Benghazi. Now, when I say revelations, I mean nothing that's a surprise to anyone who's actually been paying attention, to anybody with half a brain. But get this. Now the mainstream media is paying attention. Well, better late than never. Had to happen sooner or later. The mainstream media is latching on to the Benghazi story. Well, maybe we all better get out our ice skates because I have a feeling hell froze over this week. Also, more limitations of free speech on our college campuses. Wait till you hear what happened when former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, a conservative, was asked to speak at a college commencement service. There's only one thing that's truly commencing these days, freedom of speech. We are witnessing the final commencement of free speech in this country. And as we slowly boil the frog, it's happening a little more every single day. On the other hand, the Supreme Court made a ruling about college admissions and affirmative action, but this ruling is kind of a double-edged sword when you examine it. We will talk about all of this stuff today, but first, just to lighten things up a little, I realize that on a controversial radio show that speaks about religion and politics, those two forbidden dinner table conversations, it might sound as if those with different viewpoints have absolutely nothing in common. But there is much we still have in common as human beings, no matter how we come out on the major issues. There's a point where people are just people. And from time to time, I like to share in a way that I think just about anybody out there would relate to, but it's good for me too. It gives me a little catharsis because these are my minor observations, the smaller matters to vent about. So I'm going to do a little of this today. For example, one thing all human beings have in common, we all love to eat. And one of my favorite kinds of foods is Chinese. Not very filling, doesn't stay with you long, as the old saying goes, but delicious. Now, I don't really believe in fortune cookies. I love Chinese food, but the only supernatural predictions I take stock in come from God, or of course anyone authenticated as one of the real God's prophets. Nevertheless, we've all looked at fortune cookies just for the fun of it. Usually they tell us about the great prosperity coming our way, a tough sell these days. Still, there is one fortune which restaurants have missed for years, and it's a pity. A real pity, for this one would prove to be dead on accurate every single time. Just imagine, you're finishing your dinner of sweet and sour shrimp. You open your fortune cookie, you unravel the little note, and it says, you will be hungry again 1 hour from now. See, how did they ever miss that one? Now, actually, I've been hungry much more lately because I have purposely lost some weight lately. Have you ever noticed that the best way to hear honest feedback about your appearance is to change your appearance? Then your friends and family and acquaintances give it to you kind of retroactively. Now, most of my friends who've noticed that I've lost weight have actually been very positive and very encouraging, but it doesn't always go that way. In fact, I see with others around me when I see them losing weight and I watch how their acquaintances talk to them, boy, it's interesting. Have you lost weight? You sure have lost weight. Wow. No kidding. You look terrific. I mean, you looked like a real tub of lard before. I mean, cars couldn't even drive around you. They didn't have enough gas. See, people have this uncanny ability to give insults, all the while patting themselves on the back for the encouragement they think they're offering. Speaking of losing weight, one of the many things, and there are quite a few different things I'm doing, but one of them is regular fasting at intervals. It's one of those foolproof diets. We've all been up late at night and we've seen that groundbreaking diet on an infomercial, and you can send them a lot of money and learn all about this diet. Well, I have one. Try this groundbreaking diet out for size. Absolutely guaranteed to lose weight. You just don't eat. That'll do it. I'm telling you. Number of years ago, my church was participating in the national 40-day fast. Now, I remember hearing at a church meeting about a special 4 a.m. prayer meeting. I think people are certifiably insane to get up at 4 in the morning to pray. But anyway, I'm doing something much more spiritual around that time. I'm sleeping. But 4 a.m. prayer meeting, but it wasn't just a prayer meeting. It was a prayer and fast meeting. Okay, that's fine. But guess where they were going to hold it? They said, we're going to have a special prayer and fast meeting Saturday morning at Denny's Restaurant. Yes, you heard me correctly. You can't make this stuff up. Now, I'm trying to wrap my head around this. How does one go about choosing a restaurant as a place to celebrate fasting? But I like Denny's. I like anything familiar when it comes to food. With every restaurant I go to on a regular basis, and I go to a lot of them, I always know ahead of time just exactly what I want. Now, I eat a variety of things because I go to a variety of restaurants, but in each restaurant, I have the one thing. There's the one thing I order at Olive Garden. There's the one thing I order at Pinnacle Peaks. There's the one thing I order at Chili's. There's the one thing I order at Applebee's. If it's fast food, there's the one thing I get at McDonald's, the one thing I get at Jack in the Box. You get the point. I never even bothered looking at a menu anymore. Now, I'm sure there are all kinds of good entrees that I would enjoy just as much, but I figure if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Now, throughout human history, whenever brave souls, certainly braver than I, have been adventurous enough to try some new exotic dish, the words that provide courage and lure them in for the kill are, try it. It tastes just like chicken. Yeah. Right. Just like chicken. Frog legs taste like chicken. Snakes taste like chicken. Probably termites taste like chicken. I have a theory. Maybe all foods really just taste the same and chicken happens to be the first thing people ever ate. But perhaps more predictable than my eating habits is restaurant service itself. That's real predictable. We've all been in this situation. This is going to sound familiar. The waitress asks if your party is ready to order. And of course, there's always one person in the group who's not ready yet, right? He or she says, can you give us just a couple of minutes? Just a couple of minutes, and then we'll be ready. The waitress says, sure. As a matter of fact, she says it with enthusiasm. She's even kind of chipper. Sure. Indeed, it is beginning to look like somebody made her day by asking for a few extra minutes. Well, I'll tell you exactly what happened. In the mind of the waitress, she was just given permission to take a little break, or perhaps to catch up on something at the register. It will be far more than a few minutes now, the few minutes you requested, far more than them before she returns to your table. Truth be told, you may not see her again until you get up and go hunting for her. Moral of the story, when a waitress finally makes it to your table, and finally asks if you are ready to order, you say yes. This isn't rocket science. The answer to the question, are you ready to order, is yes. Now, this leads us to Murphy's Restaurant Laws. Murphy's Restaurant Law number one. The longer it takes them to bring you your order, the more it proportionally increases the odds that it will be made wrong when you finally get it. Haven't you noticed? I remember years ago I went to Burger King, and I liked their chicken sandwich. This was my one thing at Burger. And I like a plain chicken sandwich. I hate it when they slop mayo and stuff like that. Just plain chicken sandwich, plain the way the good Lord intended it to be made. And they're taking forever, just forever. It's this college student that's back there working. And I just knew that when they finally gave it to me, it was going to be slopped with mayo all over. Because it's just the same incompetence that takes forever is the same incompetence that gets it wrong. That's why. It's not that I'm a prophet or anything. It's just this makes sense. Well, finally, after I must have been waiting 30 minutes for this chicken sandwich. So he gives it to me, and there's mayo all over it. So I turned to him. I said, excuse me, I ordered this plain. I kid you not. The dude looks at me and goes, oh, so what do you want me to do? I said, well, I'd like you to make it again and make it right. It didn't seem like anyone had ever talked to him quite like that before. Well, that was Murphy's Restaurant Law number one. The longer it takes them to bring you your order, the more it proportionally increases the odds that it will be made wrong when you finally get it. Murphy's Restaurant Law number two. When the hostess, you walk into the restaurant, there's the hostess, and she looks a little busy, and then she sees you, and she says, I'll be right with you. Okay, your old pal Bob's going to decipher that. You know what it means when she says, I'll be right with you? It means she will not be right with you. If she was really going to be with you soon, she would not have needed to say anything. The very fact that she had to go out of her way to say, I'll be right with you, means she's very aware she will not be right with you. What she's really saying is, I just acknowledged your presence, so you're going to be cool, aren't you? And that leads us finally to Murphy's Restaurant Law number three. You've been waiting forever. You ask the waitress to check on your order. She returns and she says one of two things. Either she says it's coming right up, or she says it's cooking right now. You're inquiring to find out what happened to your order. She says, I'll go into the kitchen, I'll check. She comes back, she says, it's coming right up. Or she says, it's cooking right now. She might say both. It's coming right up. It's cooking right now. What does this mean? This means they forgot all about it. Had you not asked, your order would have been as lost and forgotten as King Solomon's mines. After you brought their attention to the situation, they panicked, and they quickly threw it on the grill. Well, those were Murphy's Restaurant Laws. Now, little restaurant lies are harmless. When our own president lies, it's a much more crucial situation, and we will examine his lies when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Now at 888-344-1170. That's toll free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to KCBQ 1170. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. I'm reading an article from Fox News, and this is about this Benghazi fiasco. A Republican lawmaker is renewing his push for a select committee to investigate the Benghazi terror attack following the release of emails tying a White House aide to former UN Ambassador Susan Rice's controversial Sunday show statements about the attack. You'll remember she went on all those shows and they claimed that this was spontaneous violence as a result of a YouTube video that said unflattering things about Muhammad. Turns out it was really a terrorist attack from Al-Qaeda, but that didn't fit Obama's narrative that Al-Qaeda was on the run. And it's been pretty obvious to anybody with half a brain that this is what was going on. However, there's kind of a smoking gun that's now come out now. So Representative Frank Wolf, Republican from Virginia, sent a letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a select committee to be established to conduct an investigation, interview Obama administration officials, and hold public hearings on the probe. It is now abundantly clear, he said, that White House staff were directly involved in coordinating the messaging in response to the Benghazi attacks, and we're actively working to tie the reason to the infamous internet video. New emails indicate a White House advisor helped prep Rice for her Sunday show appearances and pushed the explanation linking the attack to an anti-Islamic film, and now the White House is facing credibility questions after having downplayed their role in Rice's talking points. Wolf argues in the letter that the new evidence underscores the need for a select committee with subpoena power and the authority to read classified documents. Boehner has previously stated that he opposes the creation of a select committee. Well, why not? I mean, with Eric Holder in the Department of Justice looking into this, why do we need a select committee? Give me a break. Anyway, Wolf continues. He says, while we cannot control how this administration pursues or fails to pursue those terrorists responsible for the deaths of four Americans, we can ensure that the American people learn the truth about what happened and which officials should be held accountable. Okay, folks, how do Obama's fans and surrogates get around this? I'll give you three guesses, and the first two don't count. Yes, sir, the racism charge once again. People say Obama is under criticism only because he's black. In fact, we've never had a president that's been criticized this much. That's what Sheila Jackson Lee says all the time. Just this one, she says. It's amazing to me. When else has a president been under so much criticism? Just this. Miss Jackson, where were you the 8 years that George Bush was in office? I heard Democrats comparing the man to Hitler. This idea nobody was ever criticized. Listen, the president of the United States, if he's not doing his job, is going to be criticized. That's just the way it works. Is he being criticized because of his skin color? Let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. The exact opposite is true. If the Obama administration rewrote the talking points about Benghazi just to win an election, that is an impeachable offense. But he won't be impeached. No, he will not be impeached because nobody wants to go down in history for impeaching the first African-American president. Contrary to the idea that his skin color is a liability, it ends up being Obama's greatest asset. It insulates him from opposition. He will not be impeached for lying about Benghazi any more than he'll be impeached for sicking the IRS on conservative organizations any more than his lies about health care or his lies about Fast and Furious. They go on and on and on and on and on. But will he be impeached? Don't hold your breath. I know there's a few Republicans that have signed on that they'd like to do it. And now just we'll hear people go, oh, we need bipartisanship. Bipartisanship, meaning the Republicans should do things exactly the way the Democrats want to do them, and they don't want to impeach him. So don't hold your breath. When conservative speakers are asked to give lectures at our universities, don't hold your breath for those lectures either. Universities. Yeah, that's what we're talking about. You know, college. That institution where people were once encouraged to hear both sides of an issue. Well, now I'm reading from ABC News, and don't let the word Rice confuse you. That was Susan Rice before. Now we're talking about former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, very different person. And it says on ABC News, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has backed out of delivering the commencement address at Rutgers, New Jersey University, following protests by some faculty and students over her role in the Iraq War. Rice said in a statement Saturday that she informed Rutgers President Robert Baracci that she was declining the invitation to speak at the graduation. Commencement should be a time of joyous celebration for the graduates and their families, Rice said. Rutgers' invitation to me to speak has become a distraction for the university community at this very special time. The school's Board of Governors had voted to pay $35,000 to former Secretary of State under George W. Bush and National Security Advisor for her appearance at the May 18 ceremony. Rutgers was also planning to bestow Rice with an honorary doctorate. But some students and faculty at New Jersey's flagship university had protested, staging sit-ins and saying Rice bore some responsibility for the Iraq War as a member of the Bush administration. Continuing to read this piece from ABC News, Baracci and other school leaders had resisted the calls to disinvite Rice, saying the university welcomes open discourse on controversial topics. I think I read that guy's name is Baracci. It's Baracci. I want to say Barfy when I think of what he did, but Baracci, let's be fair. The news of Rice's decision, ABC News continues to say, came a day after Baracci spoke with students protesting Rice's planned speech and told them the Board of Governors would not rescind its invitation. So he did kind of stand by her. We have to give him credit for that. But keep reading. In her statement, Rice defended her record, saying that she was honored to serve her country and that she had defended America's belief in free speech and the exchange of ideas. But she said she didn't want to detract from the spirit of the commencement ceremony. You know, it's very gracious of her to back down, but I hate it when people back down when there's a threat to freedom of speech. Somebody needs to stand up, including Baracci. Baracci said Saturday in a statement that Rutgers stands fully behind the invitation it issued to Rice, but he said school officials respect her decision. That's where you screwed up, Baracci. You should have said, well, I respect her being congenial. I do not respect what was going on. I think every professor that wants to limit free speech should be fired and not be allowed to have their own free speech anymore. Baracci said, now is the time to focus on our commencement, a day to celebrate the accomplishments and promising futures of our graduate. Really, Baracci? Exactly what are you guys celebrating? What do these diplomas represent? That students were taught how to think, or that students were taught what to think?
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
Hi, I'm Dana Wright, here to talk about Bob Siegel's book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... The title itself is an open-ended question. You fill in the rest. I'd like to believe in Jesus, but is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? How will God judge people who never heard of Jesus? Can a scientific mind really accept miracles? These are but some of the concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book has been enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians alike. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But, by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Yes, it's a bad day for freedom of speech. Conservatives like Condoleezza Rice are systematically shut down. It was just a protest from a few faculty and a few students, the minority, but the squeaky wheel gets the grease these days. There were some students from that university that sent out some tweets this morning saying that their university should be embarrassed by this. I think most universities should be embarrassed these days because this is very common, and we don't want to single this one university out. Well, speaking of universities, there's also the admission process. Michigan's controversial ban on affirmative action has finally scaled the Mount Everest of judicial review. 2 weeks ago, a Supreme Court decision came to the conclusion that the right to utilize or decline racial consideration as a criteria for college admissions is a choice best left to individual states. Now, what this means, folks, is that Michigan voters were within their legal bounds to change the state constitution, and that Michigan's public colleges and universities must accept their state's new law, which forbids racial preferences. This 6-2 verdict of America's Supreme Court overturned a lower federal court, which deemed Michigan's law unconstitutional on the basis that it discriminates. Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's usually the swing voter, wrote the majority opinion, which seems to imply that the ruling will affect more than college admissions. These are the words of Kennedy. There is no authority in the federal constitution or in the court's precedents for the judiciary to set aside Michigan laws that commit to the voters the determination whether racial preferences may be considered in governmental decisions, in particular with respect to school admissions. Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were the dissenting votes. Justice Elena Kagan did not participate, possibly because of her involvement in the same case back when she was working for the Justice Department. Writing the dissent, Sotomayor said, but without checks, democratically approved legislation can oppress minority groups. Now, it may be no surprise to all of you to hear an opposite reaction from conservative columnist Charles Krauthammer, who spoke with enthusiasm on Special Report with Brett Baer. Krauthammer said, what happened today on affirmative action will allow now a stable settlement as the country, very complex and diverse, works it out state by state exactly as you want it in a democracy. Krauthammer also said, the left is trying to institutionalize affirmative action to make it impossible for any legislature or any referendum ever to abolish it ever in the history of the country, an outrageous proposition that was rejected by the court. Now, I'm a big fan of Charles Krauthammer. He usually makes a lot of sense. Lately, I've been finding myself disagreeing with him a little. This is the second time in the last couple of months. But I need to tell you how I honestly see this, folks. I don't think either Sotomayor nor Krauthammer seem to have it quite right. Now, although Krauthammer is correct to affirm state rights, there are times when the matter is desirable only in the general sense, so long as we acknowledge occasional exceptions to the rule. As a general rule, states should be allowed to make their own laws. That's the way our country was set up. However, without limits, our country could return to those hideous days of Jim Crow laws. Now, Krauthammer may not like affirmative action, and I agree with him. I don't like affirmative action, but I don't know if he understands the implication of this, because by agreeing with the Supreme Court's decision to just leave such matters with an individual state, see, they didn't rule one way or the other than to say it's up to the states. By agreeing with their decision to leave it with the individual state, Krauthammer is also accepting the flip side. namely that states can just as easily embrace affirmative action. This means some universities in our country will continue making decisions of admittance based upon race or gender. And while Sotomayor is right when she says that without checks, democratically approved legislation can oppress minority groups, she fails to acknowledge that in Michigan's case, the exact opposite is happening. After all, the moment some minority groups become preferred, other ethnic groups will be discriminated against by default. The left and the right agree on very few things today, but both camps will still point to the Reverend Martin Luther King as a national hero. At times like this, his poetic and sound words should call our nation back to sanity. He said, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." Had the Supreme Court wanted to truly end racial discrimination, they would have ruled that race preferences should be abolished, period. They violate our Ninth Amendment. The Ninth Amendment was put in because there was concern that maybe they didn't list every possible right that could develop in a new country. So they wanted to cover other rights that should just be implied. It was a very important amendment. And it says, "The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people." So, ladies and gentlemen, if an American citizen has an inherent right to receive hotel lodging or restaurant service without race being a consideration, that same American has a right to be accepted or rejected from a university based upon merit alone. Well, if you would like to weigh in on any of this, of course, you can always reach us on the phone, but also on the internet, through Facebook, Twitter, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel.net. Richard writes and asks about Gnostic Gospels. And that's a question that I actually received from many, not just Richard. And it's the one I teased you with at the beginning of the program. What are the Gnostic Gospels and how come they weren't included in the New Testament if they offer additional reports about the life of Jesus? Gnostic Gospels, so named from the religion Gnosticism, are texts dating for the most part to the second century, but claiming first century authorship. And that's important because we do know that the New Testament as we have it was completed by the end of the first century. Now, these Gnostic Gospels were allegedly penned by some of Jesus' disciples and or close friends, such as Mary Magdalene. In fact, there is an actual Gospel of Mary, as well as a Gospel of Philip. And the most well-known is the Gospel of Thomas. Allow me to cut to the bone here rather quickly. People often ask why the church would have rejected other writings by the apostles. It's a fair question, but the question, while sincere, is based upon a false premise. And I'll tell you what that false premise is when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that he is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. Educateforlife.org.
Thank you.
back to the Bob Siegel Show. My question here is about the Gnostic Gospels. These were Gospels that claimed to have authorship from Jesus' friends and apostles. The most well-known was the Gospel of Thomas, but there was the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Philip, and people ask why the church would have rejected other writings by the apostles. Okay, look, the early church certainly would have included these controversial documents had the authorship been genuine. It was not. The apostles did not really write them. Let me say that again. They weren't included because the apostles didn't write them. Obviously, if the early church councils, which settled issues of New Testament canonicity and authenticity, if they thought for a second that the real Thomas, the real Philip, the real Mary wrote additional gospels with the authority Jesus had bestowed upon them, such writings would have been included. It's true that at the end of John's gospel, you know, that real, genuine gospel found in the New Testament because it actually belongs in the New Testament. At the end of John's gospel, Jesus did give his disciples special authority. We read about this, promising that the Holy Spirit would come and help them recall his teaching after he returned to heaven. This way, they could more accurately remember and spread his word. Although the New Testament does contain writings from some of these disciples, John, Matthew, Peter, there were many others in their company. This included the Big 12 and even a wider group of over 100. And look, if they ever discover something that was written by the real Thomas or the real Philip, I would have no problem with us considering its authority and including it. But what they're claiming today, these additional gospels that they're claiming today, known as the Gnostic Gospels, well, ladies and gentlemen, they're known as Gnostic Gospels for a reason. They contain teachings incompatible with authentic Christianity and fit much better with a completely different religion that was called Gnosticism, which became popular in the second century and in many ways competed with Christianity. In time, the overly zealous ecumenical of the day tried to blend these two religions, but the blend was like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. Gnosticism and Christianity completely contradicted themselves. Gnostics did not even believe in the same God, or even the same concept of God. They believed that some evil being created all matter, and these other beings called eons created immaterial things. And so when we consider who God is, what he demands regarding sin and repentance, it didn't even remotely resemble Christianity. Gnostics believed that anything physical, anything you could touch, anything that goes to your senses, anything physical or pleasurable was a sin. And they defined spiritual as incorporeal. Now, some people, while reading Paul's words about the flesh waging war against the spirit, assumed that Paul had a similar view as the Gnostics. Such a conclusion is not even close to the truth. Sometimes people can use the same words and mean completely different things. When Paul used the word flesh, he meant the body and soul, the physical and incorporeal part. Flesh to Paul meant the body and soul together, while being disobedient to the Holy Spirit. That's what he called the flesh, the disobedience. Conversely, when Paul called a man spiritual, he meant that his body and soul together were in obedience to the Holy Spirit. So it had to do with obedience, and it didn't have anything to do with essence. Now, many people today love to make statements such as, all religions are teaching the same thing. As you can see, there's nothing new here. This attitude about religion is not unique to the 21st century universalists. Of course, the Gospels and Epistles, which make up our New Testament, were completed by the end of the first century, even though it was sometime later before they were collected into one volume. Since Gnosticism did not become a significant movement until the second century, the teachings within these alleged Gospels reveals that they could not possibly have been written by any of Jesus' true disciples. But Christianity was still seeing plenty of growth in the second century, since along with Gnosticism, Christianity became one of the two most popular and widespread religions. Some tried to combine it with Gnosticism by creating Gnostic churches. And it was like mixing steak with peanut butter. It was also becoming widely known that a true Christian writing had no authority unless it was either written by an actual apostle. An apostle was defined as somebody who had known Jesus personally during his lifetime on earth and had followed him closely, so it had to be written by an apostle or a close acquaintance of an apostle, such as Mark, a companion to Peter, or Luke, a companion to Paul. And Paul had become an apostle because he encountered the risen Christ. For this reason, those who wanted to forge a document simply scratched an apostle's name on it. That wasn't too hard to do. The genuine church was wise enough not to be fooled by such fakery. What about the charge that the early church had some sinister agenda, such as the insinuation from that ridiculous novel, The Da Vinci Code, that the Catholic Church's low view of women caused them to omit the Gospel of Mary, meaning the Gospel of Mary Magdalene? Look, the Bible is not anti-woman or anti-woman in leadership. We don't need alternative scriptures to find a higher view of women. That high view is in the real scriptures. Galatians chapter 3, Paul tells us that as far as status in the church is concerned, there is neither male nor female, but all are one in Christ. In fact, Mary Magdalene herself is portrayed very positively in the New Testament. Did you know she's the first to encounter the resurrected Christ and import the meeting to Jesus' male disciples who at first did not believe her? Now, although the Bible is not a chauvinistic book, it was written in a chauvinistic culture. And in those days, reporting that a woman had been the first to witness the resurrection would not have been the shrewdest way to commit fraud and generate a legend. This says something about the integrity of the gospel writers. Now, let me also say a word here about the Catholic Church. Although I am not a Catholic myself, I at least want to defend the fact that Catholics over the ages had no incentive to oppress positive views of women. If they had such an anti-female agenda, why did they not omit these resurrection passages I just referred you to about Mary and Jesus? And of course, there's the other Mary, you know, that other Mary of small fame, Mary the mother of Jesus, commonly known as the Virgin Mary. Catholics actually pray to the Virgin Mary. Now, I don't believe in praying to the Virgin Mary, but they do, and this practice hardly shows a low view of women. Okay, let's wrap this up. Why were the Gnostic Gospels not included in the New Testament? They do not belong there. They are not true Gospels. They do not reflect the real teachings of Jesus, and they were not written by any of his followers, even though a few of his followers' names were scratched on top as authors. If you're just joining us and you want to chime in, you can reach me, questions@bobsiegel.net. We'll read more of your comments and questions when we return.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. Bobsiegel.net.
Okay, reading some questions. And again, you can reach me through Facebook, Twitter, questions at bobsiegel.net. This guy gives himself kind of a nickname, Gand, and he's responding to our show from a couple weeks ago. We did a couple of shows, movie reviews about the movie Noah. So regarding my movie review, he says, thank you for an accurate review of this terrible movie. Too bad and even more sad that there are a lot of well-respected Christian leaders who are giving this film a thumbs up. They side with the artistic license bit and justify it in a whole bunch of other ways. Christians seem to need endless entertainment from Hollywood, and it would be better if they thought more of getting the whole gospel message out to the unsaved instead. Well, thank you, Gan, and I'm happy you agree with me. I should tell the audience, though, if you want to go to my website and listen to these shows, I did bring on film critic Mark Boobian, who's also a committed Christian, and he loved the movie. So just to show you that, unlike the university that won't let Condoleezza Rice speak, we accept two sides on this radio show. Now, last week I brought on a Christian mother, and we referred to her only by her first name, Deb, and she was talking about the unconditional love that she has for her grown son who calls himself gay. And although she does not condone homosexuality, she treats her son with love and respect. Got a lot of wonderful comments about that show. This one's from Julie, who contacted me over Facebook. She used to work with Exodus Ministries, a ministry to gay people, and she liked that show a lot. Also, Brian, who listens from Texas, he also told me that he liked last week's show. However, Brian has a question that he'd like us to address this week. He says, Bob, I have an odd question, and I would like to hear you take a minute to address. I have never heard anyone talk about this, but I had a weird thought today. So Jesus died or was killed on Friday, Good Friday, then rose back in the body on Sunday, which is now Easter. So what did he do, and where did he go for Saturday? Yeah, what did Jesus do on Saturday? Did he take a trip to Bermuda? I don't think so. Anyway, Brian goes on. He says, you think he went back to heaven, checked in with his father, then came back? That's the basic question. Not sure I stated it right, but I think you can infer what I'm getting at. Well, you stated it fine, Brian. And actually, Brian, you're very close. Jesus did go into the afterlife, but not to God the Father. He went to a place called Tartarus, which is a compartment of Hades. Now, let me define both. Hades, one of several words in the Bible used for hell, is a kind of holding cell for souls awaiting judgment before Jesus. Another word for hell is Gehenna. Gehenna is the final destination where people exist separated from God for all of eternity. It's like the difference between jail and prison. A person is arrested, then goes to jail while awaiting trial. If he's found guilty during the trial, he's then sent to prison. So in Hades, people await judgment, but there was another section of Hades called Tartarus in which angels, disobedient angels, await judgment. And these were disobedient angels from the days of Noah. Now, that Noah movie actually referred to them, but with the same kind of inaccuracy as everything else in that stupid movie. But the real story, it sounds far-fetched, but it's actually the truth. In reality, some angels in heaven back in the days of Noah transformed themselves, taking on human bodies, something God had never intended for them to do. They came to earth and had sexual relations with females, mortal females. Their children became known as the Nephilim, kind of a half-breed, half-angel, half-human being. God judged this action by doing several things. First, he banished those angels, the parents, to Tartarus. Then he sent the flood, destroying the Nephilim. The disembodied spirits of Nephilim are demons. Now, one reason demons are so obsessed with human bodies is that they once had bodies of their own. And one of the reasons I know this stuff is true is I've actually cast demons out of people. Well, can I tell you, folks, it's true. It happens. You're not going to read about it in the New York Times, but it's true and it happens. If beings from heaven having sexual relationships with humans sounds like Greek mythology, which it does, it's probably because Greek mythology is a warped, degenerated distortion of an original true account, which far predates Greek mythology historically, I should say. In any event, the spirits Jesus spoke to in Tartarus are these evil angels. Jesus is evidently proclaiming the judgment that awaits them, and he proclaimed that judgment during that in-between time between his death on Friday and his resurrection on Sunday. Now, here are a couple of scriptures that back this up, that tell us about these angels. One is in Jude, verse 6. There's only one chapter in Jude, so we just say Jude 6. And angels who did not keep their own domain but abandoned their proper abode, he has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. So see, they haven't received their judgment yet. They're in a holding cell. And then 2 Peter, this was a real apostle, Jesus, Peter. 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 through 5, he says, "For if God did not spare angels when they sinned but cast them into hell," and the word he's using there in Greek is Tartarus, "and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly," et cetera, et cetera. He's making this point, but catch the point he made about the angels. Now, Brian, back to your original question, Christ's journey between Friday and Sunday morning. Well, Peter addresses that in his first epistle, 1 Peter chapter 3. "For Christ also died for sins once for all, the just for the unjust, so that he might bring us to God, having been put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he went and made proclamation to the spirits now in prison, who were once disobedient when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through the water." Here the word spirits is used instead of angels. The terms were often interchangeable in scriptures. Also, the term Hades is used here instead of Tartarus, but since Peter is talking about angels, which he makes clear in his second epistle, then obviously Tartarus is a compartment of Hades, and Peter understands this. Now, how do we know Jesus didn't go to heaven to be with his heavenly Father during these days that preceded the resurrection? Quite simple. The resurrected Christ told Mary Magdalene very plainly. Remember, I talked a few minutes ago about how Mary Magdalene was the first to encounter the resurrected Christ. We read about this in John chapter 20. And he told her that he hadn't gone to the Father yet. John 20, starting with verse 16, Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said to her, "Stop clinging to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. But go to my brethren and say to them, I ascend to my Father and your God and my God." Okay, well, we only have a few minutes left, so let me talk about what we're going to have on future shows. I told you I do an online column called Forbidden Table Talk. I also teach a class at Skyline Church, which if any of you do not have a church home, you're welcome to come. It's 11 o'clock on Sunday mornings at Skyline. And that class is also called Forbidden Table Talk because it's a chance for people to throw out any question they want. And we do Bible studies also. Right now we're going through 2 Corinthians. But a lot of times, particularly for 10 or 15 minutes at the end of each program, and sometimes in between some of our Bible book studies, we just make it all Q&A. And lately, we did a very interesting exercise in the class. Dana, who you've heard on this show as a co-host, she's also part of that class. And she came up with a great icebreaker one morning where she asked people to write down any questions that they would ask God but they think might not get answered this side of heaven. And it turns out that some of them probably can't be answered this side of heaven, but a few of them can. So I've taken the time to answer a few of them, not because I've figured anything out, but if it's something that the Bible has addressed, then we can certainly mention. And let me tell you what some of these are, because in the next few weeks, I think I'll do one or two of them each week along with whatever else we do. By the way, my guest next week is Richard Nixon. I kid you not. It's not the same Richard Nixon because he's dead, and unlike Jesus, he has not risen from the dead. But it's another guy named Richard Nixon who wrote a fascinating book about the limitations that's supposed to be on the court and the myth. And I've mentioned this many times, which is why he and I are kindred spirits, the myth that the Supreme Court is here to interpret our Constitution. But we'll also do questions such as if the Bible is so clear, why do we have different denominations? If somebody lost a child, will I see my child in paradise? Where do babies go? And they have very important questions. Anyway, it is always great to be with you, to have your questions. We hope what I shared today was a little bit helpful, at least. We'll see you next week. Thank you.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.